Welcome to Nowhere to Run with Christopher White.
Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Welcome to a special edition of Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. You can go to the website, which is conspiracyclothes.com/nowhere to run, and you can email me at chris@conspiracyclothes.com. That's chris@conspiracyclothes.com. In this episode, we're going to be interviewing Barry Chomish. Barry is a very interesting guy who has been an investigative reporter about the issues concerning the real Israel and what's really happening there for many, many years. He is a wealth of information, and in this hour and a half interview, we touch a lot of subjects in this regard. So stay tuned and listen to as much of this as you can. It's all very, very interesting. Here is Barry Chomish. First of all, Barry, I really respect you as an investigative reporter, and that's one of the things that really strikes me in researching your work, is that you really get in there and investigate a lot of stuff, and it really shows in your books, especially, where it's just a lot of different details of you making the calls and going to the places, but also in your newsletters. And I guess my question is that what your goal was, to be a good investigative reporter? How did you come to that job?
Oh, no. I mean, I didn't want to write this. This is now called conspiracy literature in a very derogatory way. But it's actually just reporting. This is where people mix up. The word conspiracy is now really negative, and it's not negative. Conspiracy is a crime with two or more people. There's nothing wrong with that word. But the work I've been doing is under the surface, who's wrecking Israel. And before that, I was just a normal journalist. I was the Israeli correspondent for a few dozen newspapers, big ones like Billboard and the Hollywood Reporter and so on and so forth. And then Yitzhak Rabin got murdered, and I knew it was what you would call a conspiracy. I knew the guy being set up for the murder was a patsy, and this was based on originally just plain ordinary public knowledge. The big one was that after Yigal Amir, that's the patsy's name, shot his first bullet at Rabin's bodyguards let him shoot two more and shouted, "Don't worry, they're blanks. This is an exercise. They're dummy bullets." They shouted out these things, which of course makes no sense. Try and find another murder in history where after the assassin shoots, the bodyguards, instead of killing him, which they're trained to do, all shout that it's fake. And, there's only one explanation for this. They had to have been told it's an exercise, or else they wouldn't all react this way. And with that start, I started digging. And there weren't many people digging, and there were really just three or four of us. And when it comes down to it, I was the only one who had a national hit book. My book, Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin, came out in Hebrew, Russian, and English in 97, and made the top of the Israeli bestseller charts in Hebrew, actually. And it had a major effect on Israel, because by then I had gathered the hospital records. Government told us Rabin was shot twice. The hospital said three times. I'd gathered the police records. The government said Rabin was shot from half a yard's distance. The police said no, point blank, zero distance, because the bullet tore the clothing. It was zero distance, barrel on the skin, and on and on. And over the years, it got to the point where I got the police records on the ballistic records that show that Yigal Amir's hands were tested, and there was absolutely no signs of gunpowder or metal or anything you're supposed to have when you shoot a gun. And I proved it. I proved that Rabin was, in fact, not shot by the patsy. He was, in fact, shot by his bodyguard, Yoram Rubin, who was, took his orders from the head of the Shabak, then Carmi Gilon, who was promised a tremendous career by the real murderer of Yitzhak Rabin, who was Shimon Peres, who is now Israel's president. Now, should I go on a little bit about Peres?
Well, sure. We definitely probably should go into that, you know, early and often. So go ahead.
Well, I just put out an article. Now, keep in mind, I interviewed Ron Pundak. He is one of the two Israeli authors of the Oslo Accord. That's the accord that will destroy Israel, and it's well on its way to doing it. But Ron Pundak, well, the story, I'll simplify it. I went to a party, a Hanukkah party in 1993, December. The host was a well-connected left-winger. He said, you know, we're friends with Ron Pundak. You want to interview him? And this is just a month after the Oslo Accord was signed. So I said, yeah, I want to interview him. Within, 2-3 days, I was in Tel Aviv with my partner at the time. That was Joel Bainerman. Some people may know him. He's the author of Crimes of a President. In its time, it was the first expose of the Bush family. It was quite influential in 1991-92. And he was my partner. We had a newsletter called Inside Israel, and we went down and met the author of the Oslo Accord. Now, keep in mind that he thought we were sympathetic, and he was just bragging. Everything he thought he did was great, and we knew that everything he did was a disaster. So we have this conversation where he's telling us the truth. First of all, Shimon Peres had nothing to do with the Oslo Accord. Rabin hid it from him. The real fathers of the Oslo Accord were someone, a real, real son of a bitch named Yossi Beilin and Yitzhak Rabin. And he tells us all these things. And he gives us a little background, a serious background. He said that Warren Christopher was very skeptical at the beginning, but he really came around in March. And I said to him, Christopher knew about this? And he said, Christopher phoned us from the first evening we were in Norway. And now, just to remind you, Warren Christopher belongs to an organization called the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a think tank in New York that determines American diplomatic policy. Without diving into that, just for a moment, assume I'm right about that, and I am. Bill Clinton was the president in August of 93, also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and when he hears about the Oslo negotiations, he's shocked. He doesn't know if they're legitimate or not, and he doesn't know if he should accept them. All a big lie. All a lie. Christopher, according to Pundak, who, you know, he was there. Christopher was behind the negotiations from day one. And from that point, I investigated other sources, but leave it at that. The Oslo so-called peace accord was an accord of the Council on Foreign Relations, a think tank in New York, and not a very big one, about 4,000 members. And Pundak went on, but the point I'm going to make now is we were just about to leave, and Pundak said something that I didn't understand. Joel did, because he wrote this book and had a clue what the New World Order was, and I didn't. Back in 93, I certainly didn't. And Pundak says, you know, my boss, I remind you, that's Yossi Beilin, But he was the deputy to Shimon Peres and so on. It's the same foreign ministry of the Israeli government. He says, my boss doesn't believe in borders. And I didn't know what that meant. And I said to him, what are you getting by that? He said, well, without borders, there wouldn't be wars. And I said, well, without borders, there wouldn't be Israel. And he said, at the end of Oslo, what we're going to get will be much better than Israel. He said, we're going to have a block in the Middle East, and Israel will meld into it. We'll all be trading partners, and we won't be at war because we won't have separate states. And to me, this was shocking. I mean, really, from that moment on, I was just screaming, and no one very much was listening, unfortunately. I said, the people who organized and signed this Oslo Accord are absolutely nuts. Said, you don't know what it means. It means the end of Israel. This is what these people are planning.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, especially in about the Oslo agreement. Well, now, you said in the book Save Israel that, and correct me if I'm wrong here because I probably am, but that the CIA, under the direction of the CFR, were training PLO terrorists to essentially demoralize certain settlements, and this was a part of the Oslo agreement. Is that still consistent, and what else did you find around that, and if you could explain that situation a little bit?
Well, of course. I mean, that's George Tenet of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the head of the Middle Eastern Department of the CIA at the time, and Robert Deutsch, he was the head of the whole CIA of the Council on Foreign Relations. And there were secret agreements in Oslo, which I saw the copies of. This is another story I'll dive into shortly, where I was given the secret agreements by a real brave leaker inside the Israeli government in charge of the communications department of a major... I'm not supposed to say. To this day, I promised him I wouldn't name him, and I've actually kept to that, but lots of people know who he is in Israel. He did some very serious leaking. But nonetheless, the destruction of Judea and Samaria or the settlements secretly by supplying the PLO with masses of weapons was agreed to. And Peres, after Rabin was murdered, was prime minister for long enough to make sure that the PLO were trained in the United States, initially in Virginia, later on elsewhere in the United States, to be really good killers, but not, of Jews. I mean, outright, Paris knew he was killing Jews.
But this was like in the Jerusalem Post and stuff, wasn't it?
The agreement was an Israeli national agreement. The Prime Minister of Israel cut a deal with George Tenet of the Middle East Department, later of the whole CIA, to train PLO policemen. They called them policemen. And these are standard bloodthirsty terrorists. And they got super-duper weaponry, and they learned to really kill. They learned to ambush. They learned to escape. They weren't so good before then. Israel had very few problems with the PLO before then. After getting some solid CIA training, the terrorism just went through the roof. I mean, just through the roof of Israel. There were years when you had 500 dead.
The official story, though, is what I'm trying to get to, is that they were supposedly being trained to police the area, not to be terrorists. They were admitting
to cut down terrorism. They were there to go to war against terror. That's what the Israeli people were told. Now, it doesn't take a major genius to know if you give the PLO American weapons and the Israeli weapons. Israel gave them 50,000 Kalashnikovs with a million rounds of ammunition, actually gave the PLO the weapons to kill Jews. That was in the Oslo Accord. Or let's put it this way. The Israeli people found out about it the hard way when they started dying. Now, let me go back to Paris for one second while I can. I just wrote a piece. Now, I have a very, very good source in Las Vegas, actually. He sent me Shimon Peres' speech from the Bakersfield Business Conference of October 10th, 1998. I'm going to just give you the quotes. Well, here is what Shimon Peres told the gathered. One, protecting our lands is not as necessary as in the past. Right. Two, the world has no borders. Three, how can you conduct foreign policy if you don't have an enemy? Enemies stem from nations. Dangers are global. It's the same with security. You need security only if there are nations, not if you do not have any. And finally, business is now internationally minded. He opened his mouth. He must have been drunk. I'll tell you something. These are the secrets of the Council on Foreign Relations. You're not supposed to tell that the whole idea is to destroy nations. And Israel right now is being picked apart. And by the way, its borders now, anyone who calls Israel expansionist is living in Jupiter. I mean, he's just orbiting another planet. Israel has chopped away its borders from the Sinai to the Golan. Out comes the Gaza Strip, out comes most of the West Bank. Pretty soon, Jerusalem's on the block. Piece by piece, Israel will be thoroughly defenseless. Whether there's going to be, and there's going to be a missile war against Israel, there's 100,000 rockets surrounding the country right now.
Sure. I just got to say, first of all, on that, all you have to do is really look at a map to see what is that actually the Jewish lands, you know, and just to confirm what you're saying there. But I've got a few. You mentioned that Peres, Abbas, and Cheney were in Italy. And could you go on to what you found out about that? Because I think it's important. What did you find on that?
Sure, it's important. This is, again, people don't seem to understand that when the world leaders meet, it's not to discuss our protection. It's to discuss their agenda. Now, Peres and Abbas, of course, is the PLO president. So the president of Israel and the president of the PLO meet in Como, Italy. There's something called the Forum Villa d'Estate, and that's where they met. Now, Cheney should have been at the Republican National Convention, but he wasn't. He was in Italy screwing Israel. That's what he was doing. Now, just to let you know what this Forum Villa d'Estate is, where they met, I open their website and look who they brag have taken part in recent years. Now, every American is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, or was in the case of Joe Biden. And you have Henry Kissinger and James Wolfensohn and George Shultz. They're all CFR. And you have Joseph Ratzinger. He's now the Pope. But along with Shimon Peres, you have John McCain and Joseph Biden. You have the elections for the upcoming administration in the United States. Two of the four took place. Joined the Forum Villa d'Estate to what they describe as to discuss and analyze scientific and technological developments. Baloney. That's what they were there for. They were there to plan and analyze the future of the world according to their agenda. And what Peres said in Bakersfield is their agenda. That nations go, they just go straight down the tube. Their borders go, their borders are joined with other borders. And in time, there'll be a few blocks. There'll be the North American bloc, there'll be the European bloc, Middle Eastern bloc. They'll all join together into one world government run by these people. Now, the real problem when you say this, is that it sounds so nutty. People will say, it's nutty. And they're absolutely right. The people behind this are absolutely nuts. They are incredibly dangerous, and the suffering they've caused worldwide is unspeakable, but it's traceable. This is actually traceable. Israel will go down. It's going to be the next country that no longer exists. And by the way, Iraq is going to go down too, and Afghanistan is going to go down too. They're going to blend the Middle East if they have their way. So far, they've got a little too much opposition to pull it off right now, but that's the plan.
So Barry, basically, part of the core of your plan, and then correct me if I'm wrong in this, is that originally was this kind of, let's call it, bad Zionism, was that in order to bring the Jews from all the different places in the world to one area in order to more easily be able to target them? Is that your stance? And if so, and if not, was the recent leaders of Israel, all have they always had this plan, or was it a slow process of infiltration?
Oh, this is the book I wrote, Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. This is a very long argument. Let's cut it down. This is a tougher question than I think you even knew when you wrote it up. Look, Shabtai Tzvi was a false messiah of the Jews in the 17th century. He was enormous in Jewish history. More than half the Jews of the world thought he was the actual messiah. He preached an anti-Judaism, that everything in the Torah was right in its opposite sense. And what that means, I always use this example because people can relate to it. Do not murder becomes do murder. That's the opposite sense. And people thought after Shabtai Tzvi was forced by the Turkish Sultan to convert that that was the end of him, but it was not. There were followers who kept the Sabbatarian movement alive. One of the primary ones was Jacob Frank. Now, this is tricky, and I know this argument, if you've never heard it before, is tricky, but it's based on the scholarship, well, remarkable scholarship of people like Rabbi Marvin Antleman, who wrote To Eliminate the Opiates, considered really one of the great conspiracy books of all time. It's on everybody's top 25 list. It was about the Sabbateans. Oxford professor Avram Ehrlich, who I met and who gave me his research, and this man is, he's now in China, but I mean, this is a top-notch historian. Shabtai Tzvi didn't go away. There was a sect in Turkey that kept the Sabbatean movement. That's probably a wrong way of mispronouncing Shabtai Tzvi, becomes Shabtai. But Sabbateanism are followers of the incredibly secularist Shabtai Tzvi. And, well, his agenda just had lots and lots of open sex. The Jewish holidays that were fast become feasts, and it's just anti-Judaism. This, unfortunately, was labor Zionism. They were so bad for the Jewish people, it's unspeakable. There was a good Zionism. This is how history gets rewritten. It was the revisionist Zionism. These were people who tried to save the Jews from the Holocaust. These were patriots led originally by Zev Jabotinsky, and later on by Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, who history paints as fascists. And just remember about the winners writing history. It's all wrong. The points of view that people have are just based on complete ignorance. It was Begin, Shamir, Jabotinsky who tried to prevent the Jewish people from getting wiped out. It was the labor Zionists under Chaim Weizmann and David Ben-Gurion, who cut an awful, awful deal with the Nazis. In 1933, it was signed, it's called the Transfer Agreement, where the Nazis agreed to make life so rotten for the Jews in Germany that they'll have to go to Palestine. And the diplomatic order is out worldwide that any Jew that gets on a boat and tries to go anywhere, be it America, Canada, Cuba, Panama, it doesn't matter. They all get shipped back to Europe to die. You either went to Palestine or you died. And this was the transfer agreement that the Jewish Agency of Jerusalem, the Labor Zionists, signed with the Nazis. And it's, what can you say, it's the ultimate betrayal of the Jewish people. They want to start a new Jewish state of Israel based on what you would call secularism, but in fact it's based on Sabbateanism. They didn't care how many Jews died in Europe, so long as they got their breeding stock of German Jews, and that's what they got. They got 80,000 German Jews, thanks to the Nazis. And then the British closed the borders of Israel in 1939 with their famous white paper, and that was it. All the Jews of Europe had nowhere to escape, nowhere to emigrate to. It was over for them. And I'll say it, that Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of Israel, and he was head of the Jewish Agency, knew about the Holocaust. In 1936, he told the World Zionist Congress that perhaps only 2 million Jews will survive the upcoming Holocaust, but they'll be strong and good for the land of Israel. He knew what the Nazis were up to. They were planning it together, and there's much, much more to talk about this subject, and I do in my books.
Sure. Let's say that real quick. How can you get your books, and how can you sign up for your newsletter and that kind of thing?
Oh, sure. The books, well, most are at lulu.com. You go to www.lulu.com. You'll see a little box that says search. Write in my name, Chamish, and that'll take you to my books. I would first get Bye-Bye Gaza, which is the latest installment on the end of Israel. And if you want Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust, it has to be reformatted at Lulu, so get it from me. My website is www.barrychamish, Chamish, that's Chamish, .com, and I'm going to give one phone number if you want my DVDs, which Lulu doesn't sell, and my phone number is 904-315-8079, that's 904-315-8079. You can also book me for lectures if you want. Now, let's go on.
Let me kind of direct your going on there. As far as it seems like there is, and I've heard you mention before, that there seems to be a war on the religious Jews. And obviously, if these people are indeed Sabbateans, then they are very much opposed to the religious Jews. Could you give a few examples of that? And if you could maybe lead into how did it work into what was the process of getting Israel surrounded by 80,000 rockets? Who was behind
all that? Oh, it's higher now. Every month passes, more rockets come in. It's about 100,000 now. And by the way, Israel's the size of Vermont. If you can imagine Vermont being hit by 100,000 rockets, you'll understand that's the end of Vermont. Now, as for the religious, sure, it's a war against religion. The labor Zionists hate religion. They hate Judaism. They were trying to start a new Judaism that had no religion. And, well, let me tell you that everything in the Torah is wrong according to them, everything. And you have a huge error on their part. In 1976, hello?
You.
Oh, good, I heard a beep. When Peres was prime minister, he, believe it or not, Shimon Peres, was the one who signed over what is now Judea and Samaria, what was then the West Bank, to Jewish settlements. Now, the thinking back then is let these religious Jews go there and get their, get wiped out by the PLO, get wiped out by the Arabs. There was no protection for them. So he actually signed permission for the first settlements, but it grew, and it became the center of Torah teaching worldwide, became Judea and Samaria and Gaza. And these were now the new pioneers of Israel. They were taking deserted land, vacant land, and they were doing what the labor Zionists did in their day of making it prosperous. And they managed to get to today 300,000 residents of Judea and Samaria are Jews. Now this had to go. Okay, now let me tell you a little about Gaza. Gaza was the home of Shabtai Tzvi. This is where he preached from. Paul of Tarsus was Nathan of Gaza. And for Jews to be living on Shabtai Tzvi's territory was just out of this government's... and by the way, the Sabbateans who really run Israel, their numbers are very small. I would guess 3,000 to 10,000 tops. But this was a chilul. I forgot my Hebrew. A chilul. It was a curse on what Sabbateanism is, to have Torah-loving Jews in Gaza. So Ariel Sharon, who, by the way, was not a right-wing leader. I've been saying this now for 15 years. He was a left-wing leader planted into the Israeli right, by the way, by Henry Kissinger, and I have the date of the meeting, and I could go into this shortly, but the idea was for Sharon to destroy the Israeli right, which he did beautifully. There is no Israeli right anymore. There's nothing on the right. There is no more revisionist Zionism or their party, Chayrut, all wiped out by Sharon. What you have left is the Likud. And he used the Likud to get 10,000 Jews out of the Gaza Strip. And I'm talking about walking into their homes armed, making them go into buses with their hands in the air. Luckily, they were so cowardly, no one was shot.
What was the official reason for that?
The official reason, what they actually told the Israeli public,
yeah,
we'll have peace. What do you think? We'll have peace. Now, it turned into, of course, a rocket launching pad. I mean, ever since the Jews left the Gaza Strip, all the Jewish towns and cities, including Ashkelon, by the way, a mighty big city for Israel, have been pounded by rockets. But Sharon sold... Well, what Sharon actually said is the American State Department ordered me to do this, so I have to do it. He actually told a few people this. But the way he sold it to Israel, that we won't be occupying Gaza anymore. The Arabs will love us. They'll become our good friends. We won't have to do reserve duty there anymore. And of course, the exact opposite happened. As soon as the Jews left Gaza with the Israeli army, by the way, forcing them out. And I'll tell you a little story about that. I was a soldier for a long time in Israel. I fought in the first Lebanon War. I risked my neck. I wouldn't be caught dead wearing an Israeli army uniform anymore. No way I would put one on, because the army is now being used to fight Jews, and very, very poorly to fight Arabs. They lost the last war 2 summers ago in Lebanon, actually lost for the first time. It's a shameful army, and that's what was done. The army threw the Jews out of the Gaza Strip. That's where you get my book, Bye Bye Gaza, and you find out how it was done.
Is that essentially why the secret agreement in Oslo was, it was essentially... because it was Samaria, Judea, and Gaza, that was targeting essentially the religious Jewish settlements then.
And Jerusalem. Let's not forget Jerusalem.
Okay.
You're talking, what percentage of these populations are religious? All about 98.
Okay.
You know, this was an attack on Torah-believing Jews by incredibly non-Torah-believing Jews. It was a war against religion, and it will not be finished until all the settlements of Judea and Samaria are evacuated. All 300,000 people are left homeless, and Jerusalem is divided and becomes Belfast. This is in, but it doesn't matter because all of Israel will probably go before them. So, I mean, what difference does it make?
Well, let me ask you, let's segue into this because I think this is really, really appropriate. First of all, I think this is real similar to what's happening with the Vatican, where they are essentially pretending to be Christians but actually hate Christians and have killed almost 100 million Christians. But what I thought was interesting that you had mentioned that I think it was Jacob Frank or some representative of the Sabbateans met with Mayor Rothschild and Adam Weishaupt.
Yeah, that's the famous meeting in 1786 in Frankfurt, Germany, between the head of the Sabbateans in Europe, Jacob Frank, who, by the way, is considered the second Messiah of the Sabbateans. Shabtai Tzvi would be the Sephardic or Middle Eastern Messiah, and Jacob Frank is the Ashkenazic European Messiah. He's out of money. In Poland, he's been around for like 15 years. He's created an organization who have converted to Catholicism by the many thousands, and they've become spies all over Europe, intruding on courts everywhere because now they're Catholic and now they're welcome. And he created a CIA out of these Sabbateans. But he did make enough money in 1786. He comes to, he arrived in, 1786, to Frankfurt, Germany, who at the same time was home to, then a fledgling Mayor Amschel Rothschild. We are told that there was a meeting held where, Jacob Frank automatically became very wealthy. And the history books don't tell you what this meeting is. It makes no sense. I guess they're covering up the fact that the Sabbateans cut a deal with Rothschild, but there was one other party at that meeting. And Frankfurt was just the center of world conspiracy in 1786. It was also the headquarters of Adam Weishaupt, who had founded something called the Illuminati. And they all met at Rothschild's house. Rothschild just wanted to control the economies of the nations of the world. He figured that was the way to get truly rich, control their economies. At the time, he was just dealing in coins. He hadn't got really started. This meeting got him really started. You had two conspiracies going on. Sabbateanism, which wanted to destroy the Jews and have them adopt this false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, and Jacob Frank, throw him in as well. That was one, in order to do one conspiracy, in order to do this, well, what can you say? I mean, they had to destroy the actual faith of the Jews. Felt in their belonging in the world, in their heritage, in their religion, and that was done over time. If you read Rabbi Antelman's book, To Eliminate the Opiate, you discover that the reform movement and the conservative movement in America came from Germany, went to England, spread to the United States. Again, this was the conspiracy with the Sabbateans, and, by the way, the Illuminati, which I'll get to briefly. They went from Germany, which was their home, but they were banned, and we'll get to that shortly. So they went to, you know what, I'm going to get to the Illuminati right now so it makes more sense. What was the Illuminati? They were working hand-in-hand with the Sabbateans using Rothschild money. This was the meeting in 1786, one of the most important meetings ever held, and try and find a word about it anywhere. What the Illuminati wanted was the end of the Protestant Reformation. They wanted Christendom back for the Pope. Their plan was to create a new order in Europe to begin with and destroy the foundations of Protestant nations, their families, their royalty, anything that kept them together, followed by the Eastern Church, but let's not jump too far ahead yet. The Illuminati is, no matter how it's defined by people today who have it wrong, it was, in fact, a Vatican organization run by a Jesuit named Adam Weishaupt, whose goal was the destruction of any Catholicism that was not Roman Catholicism and the return of Christianity back to one pope in Rome. That's the Illuminati. So they were doing to Christianity what the Sabbateans were doing to Judaism. Unfortunately, they were discovered just before the French Revolution. Well, the story goes that a horseman, the horse tripped, and he had a satchel. Inside the satchel was the Illuminati's plans for France. They were spread throughout Europe, and the Illuminati got banned in Bavaria, and then it's just everywhere. The Illuminati got banned throughout Europe. So Adam Weishaupt, by himself or not, had a great idea. He said, we can't operate in Germany anymore. What we have to do is take an organization that already has chapters worldwide and can make us a powerful force by infiltrating them and changing their tenets to our tenets. And what he chose was British Freemasonry. And this is, up till then, you don't read about Freemasonic plots. After that, you don't stop reading about them. In short, the Illuminati infiltrated British Freemasonry. And this is, in fact, the conspiracy, the deep conspiracy everyone writes about today. The Sabbateans are not written about. And this is, well, I would hope they will be, because if they're not exposed, well, I don't think Israel has a chance.
Well, Bear, I think this is so amazing, because this paints such a picture of exactly what the problem is here, because you have essentially a representative of the Jews that say they're Jews yet hate Jews meeting with the Christians that say they're Christians yet hate Christians, meeting with the Rothschilds, who, you know, from my study of it, has kind of the seat of a lot of Satanism, at least today. I don't know if it was at that time. So essentially, you have the conspiracy that everybody's pointing their fingers at now, saying it's the Jews that did this, or it's the Christians that are doing this with the Crusades, are really only pointing at the masks of these two groups, which absolutely loathe both the groups that they supposedly represent.
Well, the Sabbateans convert. Keep this in mind, and when Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam, the Sabbatean sect in Turkey, the Dharma, also converted to Islam, but only publicly. Privately, they kept their Sabbatean beliefs, but publicly they were Muslims. The same thing in America. I'll give a few examples from the CFR. CFR people get appointed to high position, and journalists start looking into them. And what do we discover? Presidential candidate John Kerry's father is a Jew. We thought he was Irish Catholic. He was a Jew. His entire father's family came from Prague, where they were proud Sabbateans, and he covered this up. Kerry's brother now is back to being a Jew. Madeleine Albright becomes Secretary of State, and lo and behold, the lady we thought was a Protestant, her whole family is Jewish, her mother, father, cousins. She was raised by Jews, and she forgot she was a Jew. Wesley Clark bombs Bosnia to shreds and discovers his grandfather's was Jewish. His father's side is Jewish. Al Gore's daughter is married to Jacob Schiff's grandson. Oh, that's a separate issue too. How the Rothschilds infiltrated the American economy. Just leave it be that the Sabbateanism business in America is run through the Council on Foreign Relations. It's extremely dangerous, and they don't like Jews.
Well,
and
let me see if there's any connection to this before we move on to other things. I know that like Henry Meckow talks a lot about the Satanism connection as well as the Sabbateans connection. And from your study and investigative reporting, have you found any commitment to this occult kind of Satanism to in this kind of group, or is it a separate issue than Sabbateanism?
Well, I don't know about Satanism. Remember, Meckow, you know, I mean, I like him for certain things he does, and he's also become a Jew for Jesus, which has cost him a lot of his Jewish audience for reasons. Well, you know, he betrayed his own religion, so I don't really trust everything that he says. However, that said, you have to understand that in Jerusalem there is a Supreme Court building, and it was built entirely along Masonic lines, complete with the inverted with the pyramid on top of the building and the obelisk and the 30 steps leading to the three final steps to illumination. All of this is certainly not a courtroom of justice. Ben Gurion said it in 1962 in Look magazine, that there will be a world court in Jerusalem to settle all issues internationally. And the Rothschilds built this world court. It's built entirely along Freemasonic lines. And it gets worse, by the way. Now, this is my connection. You have the Rockefeller Museum, and you have the Knesset. Without diving into who the Rockefellers are, and I could, the Knesset was also built with Rockefeller money. You've got a triangle in Jerusalem that is built by what is called the New World Order. And anyone with a little bit of education walks into the Supreme Court building in Israel and feels shivers down his spine. And now this is coming from someone who wants to Judaism to survive and wants the religion to survive without any other, how do we put this? I just want Judaism the way it was for 3,400 years, 3,500 years, to return and get the Sabbateanism out of Judaism. The real problem is the Jews have to admit something very, very hard, that Israel was not founded as a shelter for Jews. They have to understand the purpose of Israel was to start a new Judaism. And it was a Judaism that, well, what can you say? A Jew cannot relate to Sabbateanism. They can't relate to the hedonism, the sensuality, the lack of what of raw morality that has kept civilization more or less intact, just as thrown out the window for this state called Israel. Israel, labor Zionism. Forget the fact of Israel. Most Israelis don't know this is happening from the top of their country. They have no idea. The religious don't believe a war is being fought against them. And, by the way, that's impossible for a rational person to believe, that they don't understand that war has been declared against the Jewish religion. What I'm trying to do is preserve the Jewish religion and from the Sabbateanism of labor Zionism.
Surely they have tried to infiltrate the religious groups as well. Has that been successful?
Oh, my Lord. Not just the religious groups. They've got the rabbis. Bye-bye, guys, is a good book to get. I talk about Rabbi Aviner, the most popular rabbi in Judea and Samaria, just completely working for the secret services of Israel. I talk about Koch, the right-wing religious group, and the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir, totally infiltrating right-wing groups. I talk about the Yesha Council, supposedly representing the citizens of Judea and Samaria, thoroughly working for the government. My goodness gracious, is that true? The government has infiltrated all of the religious right in Israel and kills the ones who, that's another issue. They've been killing the free-thinking leaders of Judea and Samaria. They've been killing them for years, so there's no one left to lead the people.
Let me plug your books real quick, Barry. I went to Lulu.com and got Save Israel, and I was really happy with the way Lulu worked and everything. I got a downloaded version, so if you're kind of impatient like me, you can get it that way too. But I was really impressed with the – I've heard a lot of your interviews, but the book that I had, and I'm sure it's true with a lot of your books, are just really packed with information and backing it up, and I really – really encourage people to check them out, because it is something that you can use for reference in trying to explain this to people, because it's right there in front of you. So I would definitely encourage that. And again, like I said, the newsletters are a great way to keep up with a lot of the stuff that's going on. It's very entertaining. How do people sign up for that again?
Oh, just write me. Go to my website, Chamish, Barry Chamish, chamish.com, or I'll give an address as well. Email me at chamishda, you know, da is for Barry, chamishda@gmail.com, and we'll put you on the list. The more the merrier. Come join in.
Barry, is there any, obviously it seems to me that the New World Order, if you will, wants Jerusalem for its capital. Can this theory, first of all, do you agree with that? And second, is...
Well, the Vatican certainly want it for their capital.
Okay. But we, you know, learn from the Rothschild-Vatican, Sabtan connection that they're probably least connected. Maybe you should go through really quickly the power structure breakdown with the CFR and what side are they on, and the CFR, the Vatican, the Sabbateans, and how's this all working?
Well, Cheney went to Rome, and then he went to Como, and he met Abbas and Perez. That's typical. In Save Israel, you'll find a long list of meetings where Colin Powell sees the Pope, George Bush sees the Pope. You know, Bush met the Pope not even a month and a half ago, and no one reported this. The President of the United States meets the Pope, and nobody knows about it, but he did. And he met him in St. John's Tower, which was where the Inquisition was run from, not in the Pope's office. And the discussion was Israel. They announced that they discussed Israel. There is a direct connection between the Vatican and the CFR. Watch out, Tony Blair, I think he's already converted to Catholicism. George Bush will convert to Catholicism. All of these, they begin as rumors and end up as fact. The CFR and the Vatican apparently are extremely tight, and not one major decision regarding Israel is made without meeting the Pope first. And now, as for Shimon Peres, party, Kadima, wins the elections. Peres gets on a plane and sees the Pope. Peres becomes prime minister, wins the presidency of Israel. Peres gets on a plane and sees the Pope. You have to follow this. I've got the dates and I've got the times in my book. If you want to use logic, well, I'll just keep on doing this then. Yitzhak Rabin is murdered. After the 30-day mourning period, Leah Rabin's wife gets on a plane and sees the Pope. All of this is really happening. As fantastic as it may sound to you, this is actually happening in Israel. The Pope and Rome, for some reason, determined the future of the Sabbateans, who are running Israel. The CFR, the Council of Foreign Relations, has got a policy, and it's a very bad policy. Israel is going to be whittled down and destroyed. That's why I keep telling people with these elections, just don't bother to vote. by McKay were both in Como for these conventions. This time it was Dick Cheney. You're getting the New World Order. You're just getting the same business, and they are going to dismember Israel. There's been a little fooling around by putting in this Sarah Palin, who is a true blue crackpot, by the way. And without diving into how scandal-ridden she is, they're all as scandal-ridden as the other. She's not outstandingly more scandal-ridden than Joseph Biden or my Lord Obama, who talked about his Muslim faith on George Stephanopoulos' show 2 days ago.
Yeah, I saw that.
All right. I mean, it's never-ending how dirty this election is, but they are all run by the CFR. Their policy is to dismember Israel. There is no escape. And by the way, the Palin thing, which is very, very disturbing to me, is that the Christians, or not all of them, but enough of them, have just bought into this woman that she's one of theirs, and she's a good Christian woman. And for years I've been telling people that the whole system has been kidnapped, and make no exceptions. You cannot support the system. It's Shanghai the world, and they're back in line because of this woman. I guess it works on the Christians.
Oh yeah, no, it's awful to see. It's like brainwashing 101. Let me ask you this: now, is that the CFR policy to destroy Israel? What with this Georgian war thing that just happened? Something is really, really interesting with that. Obviously, the NATO connections and things like that, but it seems to be far deeper. Can you go into what you have found in regards to that?
The Georgian defense minister, wait a sec, Keshurasvili is his name. David Keshurasvili is Israeli. He speaks beautiful Hebrew. The speaker of the Georgian government cabinet also speaks perfect Hebrew. Israel has been supplying Georgia with a tremendous amount of arms. And I traced how this works. The chief arms seller was Ronnie Milo, who was a member of the Likud, who somehow was blackmailed of supporting Rabin in Oslo. I later discovered another strange meeting of mine, and it's absolutely true. There's a sex industry in Tel Aviv, and Milo was hiring prostitutes just to beat him up. He's a masochist. And that was used against him to get him out of the Likud and into Rabin. He sold about half the arms for his company, Elbit, who's supplied Georgia with drones and artillery and the high-tech equipment of Georgia pretty well all came from Israel. Now, it's been hidden. It's really been hidden. It's been covered up, but Israel really kicked off Russia by supplying Georgia, not only with the arms, but the will to fight Russia. I mean, I think Georgia shot the first bullets. I mean, that's a peanut attacking an elephant. What do they want to do? Destroy themselves? Why would they want to attack Russia? And then you find out that Georgia was promised immediate NATO help and that Georgia would be defended by the West, and none of this happened, of course, and Georgia went straight down the tubes, and Russia got even with Israel by giving Syria and Iran massive anti-aircraft equipment, the top-level, super-duper number-one anti-aircraft systems.
I'm sorry, Barry. Do you think that was intentional to like provoke Russia in order to attack Israel or to arm their
enemies? Oh, no. It was intentional to spread the West or NATO into Georgia and the Central Republics. Now, look, I've heard the rumor, And so far, I don't buy it. But nonetheless, that Israel is planning to attack Iran from Georgian bases. I don't buy that, by the way. But nonetheless, I've heard that rumor. A lot of people are asking the question, besides money, all right? I mean, you get a lot of money selling arms, but you've got the Georgian defense minister is an Israeli, which is, and he speaks perfect Hebrew. And he went to high school in Israel. And no one seems to recognize that there was a direct Israeli-Georgian connection that backfired, because the Russians stood up to Georgia and backfired on whatever was supposed to happen.
But it seems like Russian intelligence would know that first off, see that very plainly. It's like, oh, this is an Israel op.
They blamed Israel every which way. And then they called the Syrian president. Assad. They brought in Assad and then the prime minister and then agreed to sell them this T-300 anti-aircraft system. Next week it's Iran. It is not a good idea to kick off Russia. Okay, and look at what the Americans are doing. What are they selling? Poland. Poland, of all things, these ballistic missiles for. America is trying to provoke a war, and when you take on the Russians, you're talking about a world war. America is trying to get the something going with the Muslims. They're in Iraq. They're in Afghanistan. 9/11 was a setup. The Arabs don't believe they did it. I got to tell you, from all my reading, it was an internal job by the Americans themselves. And I say that with some confidence. The key of the issue is somebody wants to push this world into a vicious conflagration. And I would say that the Council on Foreign Relations have their fingers right in this pie.
Let me ask you this, Barry. Now, this is a real important point, I think. Now, everybody here in America believes, for some reason or other, that when our politicians say that we, America, support Israel at all costs. Now, I have a confusing issue here because it seems like not only do we not actually support them, but we seem to be arming their enemies. And if you could speak on that, but also, would we actually support the, quote, like, New World Order government of Israel? So could they be right in saying that we support Israel in that way when they're actually trying to destroy Israel? Just give me a general idea of what's going on.
It depends who the politician is. There are lots and lots of politicians who just don't know the rules of the game. But they're not in the White House. They're not the State Department. The Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, the President, they know the game, and they determine what's going to happen to Israel. Bush determines what's going to happen to Israel, not Congress. And obviously, this was the Oslo Accord. Let's bring the PLO back to Israel. After the good Prime Minister, Begin, who was not part, he was a revisionist Zionist, he was not part of the Sabbateans, threw them out of Lebanon. And I was part of that. I was a soldier in that war. We got the PLO out of our hair. Within 10 years, the Sabbateans take over with Rabin and bring them all back. And ever since then, of course, Israel has been disintegrating. The Israeli army, by the way, it's not Israel anymore. It's just not the same country. The youth of today don't want to serve in that army. The youth of today, and by the way, I know this personally. I was a proud soldier. Israeli youth don't care about defending their country. They care about going to raves and taking ecstasy and everything but defending their country. It's not the same Israel anymore. The Jewish state is going to go straight down the drain. This is what has been done ever since Oslo, is to educate the next generation of Israelis not to care about their country and to hate the religious. And they've done a great job. Israel is divided. The secular youth hate the religious. The religious youth, they don't hate the seculars. They haven't been trained in that way, but they are extremely, extremely defensive about the hatred they feel and the legal prejudice. The police are against them. The courts are rigged. Israel is a first-class banana republic right now. That's what it is. And America, as I said, the Oslo courts were the CFR. We began this show when I told you that. My interview with Ron Pundak, one of the writers of Oslo, and Warren Christopher and Bill Clinton, they all were the founders of Oslo. Oslo's goal, and I'll say it again, Pundak told me, and I quoted Peres at the beginning of the show, was to remove Israel's borders and have Israel blend into a regional bloc. That was the real goal of Oslo. And I'll tell you something, where they screwed up, I think the Arabs may finish off Israel in the next war before Israel has a chance to remove its borders and join a regional bloc.
Barry, let me ask you this. This is something that I'm just really confused about. I'm sure you've seen the movie Pallywood and the media portrayal of the situation in Israel.
What's it called?
Pallywood?
I haven't.
You haven't seen that. Well, basically, it's detailing kind of the stock footage of like what 60 Minutes will play with their sight bites, essentially showing like, you know, all this Jewish violence on Palestinians. But then when you see the entire footage, you can see that it was all staged and that it was like it's like Hollywood called Pallywood. So
Mohammed Dura wasn't killed by Israeli troops. And then you probably have the stretcher where the guy falls off the stretcher and then gets back on.
Sure. What's the deal with that?
The deal is the PLO, well, Arabs in general. I mean, look, I'm not dissing Israel. I'm trying to get Israel to survive. As for the Arabs, they've learned Western liberalism, and they've learned how to manipulate the media, and they lie. This is a given with the Arabs. Israel's occupation, and I was a soldier in that occupation. I was a prison guard at the biggest Palestinian prison you know what? Kitziot, that's what it was called, Kitziot. I was there. Believe me, as occupations go, this one is not all that brutal. It's not that nice, but it's not that brutal. The way the Arabs have got it is that everything that they do is somehow the fault of Israel. So you've got a situation where Israel pulls out of the Gaza Strip, just leaves. Beautiful settlements, by the way, beautiful cities, manicured lawns, incredibly prospered farms, brings in the army, at gunpoint, shoos the Jews away, and the Arabs, do they manage the farms and take over the prosperity? Of course not. They take over the land and turn it into a rocket firing station. Everything given to the Arabs by Israel is used against Israel, and that includes the media. They know that the reporters coming from Europe and America are pro-Arab. They know they can feed them anything, and they do feed them anything, and it becomes news. As for Israel, they can't win. They can't win the media. They can't win diplomacy.
It's so amazing to me how anybody could even suggest that the media is like pro-Israel or anything like that, because
yeah, that's a joke.
It's literally every single story about Israel. You can just go to Google News and type in Israel and Palestinian or whatever, and it is everyone, even if it's supposedly like supporting Israel, it's worded like in, you know, saying things like, I don't know, it's just awful.
I'll give you a little example of this. I lived briefly in Vancouver, and I didn't like it that much. The mentality was just not my mentality. It wasn't real. It just was not intellectually serious enough. That's Canada in general. It's just, well, what's your favorite Canadian movie?
Yeah.
Exactly. Name a Canadian invention, and so on and so forth. It's not a good place for a thinking person. And they end up in the States. Now, I was in Canada trying to make a life. I left Israel after really a series of events that I decided were just to snuff me out. And I mean, I was in the hospital. In 2 months, I was there twice for long stays. One, a phony car accident where the police wouldn't even tell us who did it. Another, I reported on Sharon's stroke. Sharon didn't have a stroke. He drank tea with Shimon Peres, and a half an hour later was in the hospital, not even remembering his own name. And I knew what was going on, so I just rushed to Canada where I have a passport. Now, I spoke, I was invited by some Vancouver anti-9/11 group, and I was told I would be co-hosting the evening with some, I think his name was Greg. I'd never heard of him, but he started, I finished my speech, I did Rabin. This guy started on 9/11, and the stuff he was saying about Israel, he said, the stuff that got to me in the end was he said, every Israeli is a fascist. And I said, you're saying that my little kids are fascists? And he said, yes. And at that point, I just knew this place wasn't for me. And this was a hate crime. Not only was it not true, my children are the last thing from fascists. So they've been raised well. And but nonetheless, the audience didn't, well, one or two said, enough with Israel. What are you picking on Israel? 9/11 was not an Israeli operation, was an American operation. But all I heard was about Israel organizing the whole thing. Now, admittedly, there are some connections I don't like. The falling of Building 7, I was invited to speak at the fifth anniversary of 9/11, the alternative conference. They paid my ticket. I went to New York. And what my my argument was that 9/11 was felled by Larry Silverstein. Without diving into detail about Larry Silverstein, he's not such a good guy. Right. But I said he had to fell the building at 5:20 in the afternoon in the shadow of the smoldering Twin Towers, because the airplane that was supposed to hit it, Flight 93, got screwed up somehow and didn't bring down the building or at least crash into the building. This is my thesis, and it's based on lots of evidence that Flight 93 was supposed to be three planes in the World Trade Center. One of the planes was caught on to the game and didn't arrive, and they were stuck with a building filled with explosives, and they had to bring it down in a controlled explosion that takes weeks to organize, because the police and the fire people would have found the explosives, and the whole plot would have disappeared. That was my speech in New York. So I know something about 9/11, and I know there are Jews involved, but let me tell you something. There are a lot more Cheneys and Rumsfeld and people like that who are not Jewish, who are clearly involved. And this guy just would not stop picking on Israel. And it's a very disheartening situation when you're trying to bring a little balance and a little truth to the world, and you just get hit with this prejudice and bigotry and it's seething hatred.
Well, you know, Barry, the thing that kills me is that it's like, it's so obvious that that's what we're intended to think. We're getting it from every angle from the TV, from the printed news, from every single thing, all this reverse psychology to get us to, you know, hate Israel. I mean, it's like coming from everywhere. So it's hard to blame everybody for just being weak-minded, for just accepting the propaganda. It reminds me of, and I'd really, if you know anything about this, I'd like to hear you, because I think it it speaks to this. In Czechoslovakia in World War II, the Hitler's kind of propaganda attack to attack Czechoslovakia seemed very, very what this is all about. And so I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know that they attacked Czechoslovakia before they made their final mistake with Poland. They convinced the world that Czechoslovakia was actually German as they attacked them. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like Hitler couldn't really attack them.
Sudetenland. We're going to attack Sudetenland. It's actually ours. There's a bunch of Germans living there, and we have a right to attack it. And then Chamberlain accepted this this attack, and Hitler promised them there'd be no more. Yeah, I know a little about it.
Well, it just seems like that's the exact same thing happening. You know, Hitler basically started a world propaganda campaign that the Czechoslovakians were, you know, that they were on true German land, and they got the world opinion to get them to give that land back to Germany, which Hitler couldn't have got there if he wanted to. And then 6 months later, they were attacked and essentially controlled.
Well, the Arabs are very good at their obsession with Israel and their use of the media has really done a job in the 60s and up until the Yom Kippur War, at least, Israel was viewed with a pretty good heart worldwide. But since the 73 war, Israel has just been declared the oppressor. And I'll tell you, you won't have to worry about that much longer. There's going to be a Holocaust in Israel. And I don't say that lightly, by the way. My children are there. My Lord, I'm so... Look, when I say these things, just realize my sister is there. My nephew and niece are there. My closest friends. And it took me a long time to build up my social group. A person like me is not easy on average thinkers. You know, I left that all, and they're all going to be in a war soon. Something is going to spark a war against Israel. And when that war starts, there's going to be 10,000 missiles on Tel Aviv on the first day. Hezbollah has 40,000. Syria's got more than 40,000 with biological and chemical heads. And it's not just that. Hamas is another 20,000. But it's not just them. The PLO have lots of missiles. And Saudi Arabia signed a deal with Syria to bomb southern Israel, Eilat, and the air bases there. Israel's going to be swamped. It won't survive this thing. And I know about fighting. I was a soldier long enough to know you can't fight against rockets. You can't do it.
Well, I think I've almost got all my questions here, but I just wanted to point out, I'm sure you know, I mean, about Ezekiel 38 and 39, it really kind of describes a war with Russia and Iran and Turkey and Libya, basically all coming on Israel, except it getting supernaturally stopped. So, I mean, I see on one hand, I see exactly everything that you're saying to be absolutely true, that it is going to happen, it's going to be attempted, but I at least hold out hope that if this is indeed the Gog-Magog war, then it will indeed be supernaturally preserved.
You know, I find this, I've been explaining this for the longest time. I go to synagogue, by the way, on Saturdays and so forth, but I'm not taking modern events at all from ancient events. And I get on a lot of shows where they assume that I would. No, I'm just reporting the news.
I
never throw in. I never throw in theology. I want Jews to be proud that they're Jews and to fight for Israel, and that means fighting against the forces that are destroying it, and not like they did in the 30s and 40s, where they let all of European Jewry die in a Holocaust. But unfortunately, the Jewish media here, all the Jewish newspapers, are controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations, because all the major Jewish organizations, except for the ZOA, by the way, which the only one is not controlled by the Council on Foreign Relations, the big ones are controlled by people like Edgar Bronfman and Ronald Lauder and Mort Zuckerman and Henry Siegman. These are these are, well, not to mention Hamlin of New Jersey, all of the big ones are run by members of this little think tank in Manhattan, 4,000 members of the Council of Foreign Relations, and they are going to let another Holocaust in Israel happen just the same way they let the Holocaust of the Jews of Europe happen. And, by the way, that's a separate subject, and it's a whole show someday if you want it with me.
Sure.
But what worries me is the same situation is being set up, and another 6 million Jews are waiting in Israel for a Holocaust. And after these rockets land and the power is out and the army no longer functions, after all of this happens, the Arabs are going to come in from every which way. They're going to take the little settlements. They'll have a little bit of a fight, but not much anymore. They'll put the men in one corner. They'll put the women in another corner. They'll make the men watch while they rape their wives, and then they'll shoot the men in front of their wives. This is a Holocaust. And it's worrying me sick that this is coming up for Israel. And no one is doing a thing to prevent it. That's what's worrying me, and that's why I keep writing.
Right. You know, it's so obvious when I was looking at the Jerusalem Post website, it's so obvious that it's controlled by the same people that, control our media. Such fear-mongering about Iran and things like that, and it reminded me exactly like the build-up to trying to get Americans to want to go to war with Iran was the exact same thing going on there. Granted, they have probably a better reason to fear-monger in that for Israel being so close and obviously threatened ostensibly by them.
Moment Israel hits Iran, the next day Israel is finished.
Right.
People don't seem to understand the threat against Israel. I'm trying to explain. I fought in the army for a long time. I fought against the Scuds from Iraq. I spent the first Gulf War at Ben Gurion Airport with my little missiles, supposedly to stop air attacks. We could do nothing. These worthless Patriot missiles didn't knock down a one of them. Nothing worked against Scuds. Now, when you're talking about a tenth, all right, let's put it this way. 2 years ago, 4,000 missiles in 34 days, that's about 100 a day, landed in northern Israel. Northern Israel was completely emptied out. Anyone with a car took their kids and slept on the beaches of Ashkelon or Tel Aviv. If they were lucky and they could afford a hotel, they stayed in a hotel for a month. But northern Israel didn't function. No one was there. That's a crummy 4,000 in 34 days. Imagine the effect of 10,000 in one day.
Right. Well, Barry,
and
I guess
better missiles and better equipped missiles.
What is it? I guess we could pretty much wrap up here. What is it that's on your plate right now? Is there any particular thing that you are focused on? And if so, how can anybody help in that regard?
Well, sure. I mean, focused on all I do, and I keep saying this, but it's the truth. All I do is the news. I have people who are telling me what's really going on, and I report it. And I report it from the point of view of who is really controlling Israel and where that country is really going. And unfortunately, so few of my countrymen, and by the way, fewer Jews in America, I mean, they're the dumbest people you've ever met. I mean, it's impossible. The Jews in America are not being Jews. They couldn't. Their children are not going to synagogue. They're losing it. No one is going to care when Israel goes. That's my real worry. The next day, life will go on. The country will be forgotten. They'll start doing movies about the Israeli Holocaust 30 years later, and that'll be that. I can't do it. I got to be honest. It's not like I can do very much. I thought I could. I once believed in justice with Rabin. I was sure that I got the evidence. We'll go to the police. They'll prosecute Paris. He'll rot in prison. The bad guys will be gone. Then I found out that the police are not helping me, that the media is being destructive of me, that there were campaigns, real campaigns, all over the internet, all the way to Holocaust denier. Even as far as Holocaust denier, they were using anything against me to shut me up, and there is no justice, and there is nowhere to go. All I have are my loyal readers, and it's us against the world, and I think the world is going to beat us.
Well, I think that obviously, I mean, when I was looking for the truth of what was happening in Israel, and I mean, the one thing I kept coming back to was your material. You're one of the few people that I think that really I can trust. I might not agree with on everything, but I got to tell you, everything is so controlled in this thing. I just hope everybody goes to your site and gets your books, because this is extremely important. It is, everything is revolving around this in one way or another. One thing I told you before the interview that I think is really, really true is that when I was researching this issue, it's the hardest thing to research. There's so much detail in things that it's unlike any other research topic I've ever encountered.
Well, yeah, that's why I can keep on writing without end. I see that nothing is true, and I write the way it is. Look,
and your books are like this mob story. I mean, so many people. I mean, it's like everybody is getting killed, and this guy's getting killed, and his son gets killed the next day, and his son gets killed, and it's all like it's like a soap opera. What's going on over there?
Well, you can really reduce it. Israel's primary enemies are the Vatican and the Council on Foreign Relations. Those are the two primary enemies. Starting with that, it's not so hard to figure out what's going on with Israel. It becomes wide-ranging. The Sabbateans get thrown in there, and you should understand that labor Zionism was the worst curse that ever hit the Jewish people. And it gets a little complicated, but just start Vatican CFR and expand, and you can figure out that Israel's enemies do not want Israel to survive anymore.
Barry, if you were going to suggest one particular book to get people started on this that hadn't heard any of this before, which one would it be?
Bye-bye, Gaza. It's the most current. You can, if you write me, I'll send a copy of Shabtai Tzvi. It's also very important, and it still hasn't been reformatted on Lulu, but I'll send you a copy if you write me, chamishba@gmail.com. Save Israel is also, they're all good. All my books are good.
Bye-bye,
Gaz is probably the best.
Okay. And one final thing, this is really probably not a good one to end on, but I had been dealing with a lot of stuff, and I've been researching a lot of this Joan Peters thing, and I really found her sources to be of great value. And then every time I Google her, I find that Norman Finkelstein has somehow debunked her and everything, and I've been trying to track down, and I have found exactly his debunking and stuff like that. What's the deal with that? How wrong was
Joan
she?
Joan Peterson and me, we should form a club. You write the truth, and she is a very honorable demographer. And I've seen not only seen the figures of the Arab population of Israel. Well, in the 19th century, they were actually two provinces of the Turkish. They were two vilayets, they're called, of the Turkish province of Syria. There was no Palestine, there was no Israel. But the fact is, it was uninhabited. It had it was people like Mark Twain and Balzac, all these famous people who knew how to write, came to the Holy Land and were aghast at how empty it was. And Joan Peters wrote a book that proved that the visitors were absolutely right. The place is empty. And the likes, I have my own Norman Finkelsteins. One's name is Daniel Pipes. They just get on the internet and they try to debunk you when you're always right. And we'll deal with them in time. If there's victory, we'll deal with all of them. But Joan Peters is a woman of great integrity who wrote an extremely well-documented book on the demographics of Israel during the 19th century and proved that there were very, very few Arabs living in Israel, and proved that the Jews were the majority in large cities like Jerusalem, Tiberias, and Sfat. The Jews were the absolute majority during the 19th century. In other words, all the stuff that's being thrown out the window, she rolls it to the surface, and she gets the treatment I get. You get the other side determined to hush her up. And that's the situation. It's 1939. The Jews trying to prevent the Holocaust are being hushed up by other Jews, no less. And the Holocaust will come. And it's my turn. I can say afterwards, I failed.
Well, I think it's time that people start figuring all this stuff out. So I hope to really, really try to cause a stir with some of the information that you've given here today and some of the stuff that I've been researching. So I hope that we can really start to just make this a household idea, because it's the truth. And I think people are out there looking for the truth, and some people actually don't care where it leads them. So,
send me the URL. The next time I write something, I'll make sure people tune into the show.
Great. Perfect. Okay, Barry, thanks for everything. And if you ever need a platform to discuss anything, I'll be here for you. Be glad to do it anytime you have anything that you need out there.
Vice versa.
All right. Thanks, Barry.
See you later.
Bye.